Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome to The Paranoid Strain. This is an episode in the middle of our long-term, multi-part examination of the history, philosophy, and implications of human interactions with non-human intelligence. We call it unidentified because we're fancy, but you can think of it as our big UFO series. If this is your first ever episode, you might want to skip back to unidentified number one in the RSS feed to get the whole story. Please note, some of the voices you hear, especially celebrities, are generated by AI, because we feel it makes our book excerpts and other quotes more interesting. Rest assured that Fearful, Dana, and our interviewees are always us real humans, and we'll never cut that corner, now or in the future. Returning Strainiacs, we have a few requests. First, please email us at theparanoidstrain@gmail.com with feedback. We love it. If you use Facebook, please look up and join our friendly, active group. We also set up a YouTube channel, mostly just to help people find out about the podcast. But if you could subscribe, ring the bell, and play a couple of episodes in the background as you work, that would help us show up in the algorithm for folks that might enjoy us and swell our unholy ranks of fans. Finally, anyone who wants to go that extra mile is invited to join our Patreon at patreon.com/theparanoidstrain. If you subscribe at the $5 tier, I will eventually mention you in one of these intros, embroiling you in an imaginary conspiracy theory, as I'm about to do for
Tony from Akron, or as his secret brotherhood knows him, the Inflator. Ever since he adopted this moniker, his reputation has been blurred by false stories and misunderstanding. I want to take this opportunity to set the record straight. Many have wrongly assumed that the Inflator is some sort of secret fetishist, perhaps one who takes delight in overfeeding a sexual partner to their mutual gratification, or simply a balloon enthusiast of the profoundest sort. I am sorry to have to tell you that his is a far more nefarious path. He's the guy who sneaks into the nation's grocery stores and gas stations, constantly increasing prices while simultaneously shrinking packages. We are sorry to expose him as a folk villain, and hope this shout-out on his favorite conspiracy podcast will be some comfort when the villagers arrive at his door with their torches and their pitchforks.
Thanks to all of you patrons for supporting us directly, and to all of the rest of you for listening and sharing. It means the world to us. Now, let's get this show on the road. Paranoid Strain Orchestra, hit it.
We are not actually finished with Mr. Redfern, but the rest of what we have to say about him is best discussed in another context that we'll get to shortly. In the meantime, we want to run through a few unique theories put forward in the best written and least credulous of the books we perused for this section.
Please understand, he's grading on a substantial curve here.
And so we turn to The Ancient Alien Question by Philip Coppens. Let's be clear, this is a silly book. Sometimes, profoundly so. But as silly as it is, it's far more rigorous than any of the other literary clown cars I emptied out during the research process for this section. One notable thing about the book is that unlike his fellow travelers, Mr. Coppins appears to have some evidentiary standards. There are in fact theories that Coppins examines and dismisses, which is more than one can say for von Daniken.
Guess what? Come on. That's not true. Von Daniken seems to completely dismiss the flying saucer phenomenon, both in the 1974 Playboy interview and decades later in his 2019 book, Eyewitness to the Gods. In fact, his specific gripe in Eyewitness is with, as he put it, the otherwise quite reasonable History Channel Ancient Alien series.
Otherwise reasonable? Oy vey.
Dulcet interjections are my job, Jesuit. Stay in your lane. Anyway, his only problem with the series is that it takes seriously tales of Nazi scientists building underground bases in Argentina after the war, where they built and launched flying saucers that gave rise to the UFO phenomenon.
According to von Daniken, it's okay to peddle bullshit, but it better be pure, refined, Swiss hotelier bullshit, you feel? Mr. Coppins, on the other hand, at least displays a modicum of skepticism. Listen, for example, to the way he talks about the ancient aliens thesis, including the often associated suggestion that somehow the giants mentioned in the Bible's first books are potential evidence of these ancient alien gods.
All legends can be interpreted in a number of ways. In the Bible, it is clear that there is a body of evidence that together clearly argues for the presence, in biblical times, of a race of giants. But the presence of these giants in itself is not proof that ancient aliens once bred with human women. Legends, by default, cannot be proof, but we can accept them as evidence. And when we take the whole rather than individual details, it is clear that there is substantial evidence to suggest that gods once came to our ancestors, interacted with them, on occasion guided them, and also seemed to have helped them in the endeavor known as civilization. When we turn to ancient Egypt or Sumer, and their claims that gods once ruled their nation or taught them civilization, we cannot look elsewhere on planet Earth and find evidence of a civilization far enough advanced to have sent missionaries to these cultures. Nor have we ever found evidence of creatures that lived 1,000 or maybe tens of thousands of years. But again, whereas a case can be made that the gods of the Bible and other legends are truly extraterrestrial beings, there is currently no hard proof.
On the one hand, he's far, far too accepting of the ideas underpinning ancient astronauts. But on the other, he clearly at least feels the urge to justify his beliefs with some kind of genuine evidence. To express skepticism at wild claims, you know, to display basic rational thought. In another example, he takes us through the theory that holds that ancient peoples knew the secrets of nuclear technology, and not only used nukes in battle, but recorded their horrific effects in their ancient writings. He begins by discussing the theory propounded by Zechariah Sitchin.
Perhaps the only ancient aliens author whose influence and reputation among believers rivals von Daniken's. We're covering him in depth soon.
This theory holds that in the 3rd millennium BCE, there was nuclear warfare on the Sinai Peninsula in modern-day Egypt.
In support of this conclusion, Sitchin consistently pointed to photographs of the Sinai Peninsula taken from space. They purportedly showed an immense cavity and crack in the peninsula's surface, revealing where a nuclear explosion had taken place. He explained that the area was strewn with crushed, burnt, and blackened rocks, which contained a highly unusual ratio of the isotope uranium-235, indicating, in expert opinions, exposure to sudden, immense heat of nuclear origin, to quote Sitchin. Alas, he provided no further details as to who these experts were or where they had expressed such opinions, thus weakening his case despite what would otherwise be very good evidence.
Well, sure, it would be good evidence if it was conducted by qualified scientists subjected to blind peer review and ideally reproduced by subsequent researchers. But since, as Coppins notes, Sitchin doesn't bother to identify his sources or provide any other way of checking his declarations, we can hereby invoke the principle coined by the late and sorely missed essayist, critic, and wildly entertaining debater, Christopher Hitchens.
To wit, that which has been presented without evidence can be dismissed without evidence.
Digression. This idea, which is just unbelievably useful when it comes to conspiracy theories, has been popularized in the years since Hitchens' death. It's now known as Hitchens' razor, joining the constellation of other useful shortcuts in argumentation and philosophical reasoning, such as Occam's razor.
That is, do not multiply assumptions in an explanation, or, as it's often expressed, the simplest explanation is usually the right one.
Hume's guillotine.
Facts about the world cannot be used to draw ethical conclusions. Or again, simplified, you can't derive an ought from an is.
And of course, Hanlon's razor, which every conspiracy theory skeptic should at minimum have in a framed crocheted sampler on her wall, if not tattooed on her forehead.
Never attribute to malice that which can be explained by stupidity.
Coppin's occasional skepticism appears again a few sentences later regarding another attempt by Sitchin to justify the ancient Sinai A-bomb theory.
In recent publications, Sitchin has also argued that the article Climate Change and the Collapse of the Akkadian Empire, Evidence from the Deep Sea, which was published in the April 2000 issue of Geology, is confirmation of his claim. The essay argues that an unusual climate change occurred in the areas adjoining the Dead Sea, which gave rise to dust storms, and that an unusual atmospheric mineral dust was carried by the prevailing winds over the Persian Gulf. According to Sitchin, this was due to an uncommon dramatic event that occurred about 2025 BC. Alas, consultation of the article itself reveals that Sitchin has been more than selective in his summary of it. Though the article states a catastrophe did occur, it also clearly reveals that the likely cause of this climate change was a volcanic eruption, not a nuclear explosion. The article is unable to identify which volcano was responsible for this sudden climate shift, but clearly correlates the presence of volcanic ash with the ensuing disasters. And volcanic ash is very distinct from nuclear fallout. In short, the quoted report is not evidence of a nuclear explosion at all. As there are specific references to volcanic ash in the abstract and summary of the report, the question should once again be asked, why Sitchin failed to see or report this?
I don't want to go casting aspersions, but I have an idea why Sitchin might not have wanted to mention this, and it has a lot to do with selling books to people who never ever are going to check his research because they just want to believe his story. There are other examples throughout the ancient aliens question where Coppins really does poke holes in various ancient alien believer shibboleths, including popular ones like the ancient Mayan astronaut idea you may have run across thanks to the internet.
At the ancient Mayan city of Palenque was a tomb that was discovered in the 1950s. And inside this tomb was a lid on this sarcophagus for Lord Pakal. And that lid is very highly decorated with a picture of Lord Pakal. And in that picture, he's doing some really unusual things.
You see a man bending forward, almost like a rising motorcyclist. He has his nose on some kind of oxygen mask. He uses his upper hand to manipulate the knob. You see his lower hand, he manipulates some controls. He's sitting on a kind of chair in a sort of capsule.
When Eric looked at that lid, he saw a Mayan king in a rocket ship. And that guy was returning to the stars, going back into space. It was an exciting interpretation. And it was one of the main things in Chariots of the Gods. And when other people looked at that lid and saw his explanation, they had to agree with him.
In brief, there is a carving on a 7th century Mayan sarcophagus that, according to believers, depicts the king entombed within as flying in what looks like a rocket ship, if you're already inclined to see that sort of thing. Also, in order for it to appear to be a rocket to the stars, you have to turn it 90 degrees, at which point believers insist you can see that the king has his hands on the controls of his spaceship, his foot on the pedals, and flames coming out the bottom. Coppins can take it from here.
Archaeologists strongly disagree. They interpret the lid depicting Pakal descending into Xibalba, the Mayan underworld. They support their conclusion by showing that below Pakal is the Mayan water lord, the guardian of the underworld, and the device is, in fact, the world tree. One of the best detailed explanations of the lid is offered by Linda Sheely and Peter Matthews, who, in the Code of Kings, conclude that Pakal falls in death, but his very position also signals his birth into the other world. And the end result, when tilted 90 degrees, is indeed suggestive of a space bike riding king. Given that this image is on Pakal's tomb, depictions of the underworld and the world tree are definitely more apt than a vehicle. Pakal's tomb is evidence that treating objects in isolation can sometimes mean that the answer is no. As with the Nazca lines, though, posing the ancient alien question did mean that science was pushed to come up with the correct answer.
That last bit, suggesting it was only because the ancient alien loons started producing wild theories that scientists were pushed to generate better theories of their own, is some egregiously self-serving editorializing, designed to convince readers that, all evidence to the contrary, there's some sort of genuine conversation going on between qualified experts on the one hand and raving egotists like von Daniken on the other. This is, obviously, bullshit. But let's offer another hurrah for Coppens here. He is a cut above von Daniken or Sitchin, or even Redfern, with his Rh-negative, paranormal abilities, codswallop. I'm afraid that's as much complimenting of the man's ideas as we're going to do right now, because most of the topics and arguments he stumps for in this book are, to be generous, paper-thin and would be laughed out of any peer-reviewed publication.
And worse, Coppens at points tries to use a halo effect from his far-between moments of reasonable skepticism to suggest to the reader that his dismissals of real scientists doing real science are more believable because, after all, he's willing to take on both sides.
He uses this rhetorical cover to take unwarranted swipes at scientists, as he does here, when arguing that common sense and evidence should tell us that the pyramids could not have been built by those dumb, dumb ancient Egyptians.
A very stupid and baseless argument we've debunked previously.
True, but Coppens' spin is particularly egregious.
Choosing to remove the responsibility for construction of the Great Pyramid, or any other monument from the native culture, is a dangerous exercise that today will greatly upset the scientific establishment. Indeed, it is clear that for science, keeping all buildings native to the culture in which they are found is far more important than actually going with the available evidence. And in the case of the Great Pyramid, it was its accuracy, which far exceeded the accuracy of other buildings of its time in ancient Egypt, that has prodded so many to conclude it was built by non-Egyptians, but the available evidence actually suggests that Khufu, an Egyptian, did build it, but that somehow he had at his disposal information and building techniques that did not seem to have been used before.
You hear that? He's suggesting the only reason that scientists insist the Egyptians built the pyramids is essentially what we formerly called political correctness, and what people who are very worried about terms they can't actually define would these days call woke. I think a more reasonable interpretation would be that Coppens prefers the idea that aliens built these structures and is willing to dismiss careful study and cautious conclusions when they don't match up with his presuppositions.
And, as we just pointed out, it is indeed true that archaeologists, anthropologists, and historians took a cavalier approach to their work in previous centuries, and that this unwillingness to question their own presuppositions led to a great deal of misinformation making its way into the mainstream of research, where it remained for decades until better methodologies let these mistakes to be corrected. But Coppens, von Daniken, et al. Want to continue using a damn the torpedoes full speed ahead approach to these topics, because cutting corners helps make their pet theories seem more reasonable. So here, Coppens tried to score rhetorical points via a bait and switch, suggesting that the modern research paradigm is careful, not because scientists learned the hard way from previous generations' errors and therefore are less likely these days to make these sweeping assumptions like ancient aliens fans prefer. No, these cowards are just kowtowing to the popular politics of the moment and thereby dismissing new revolutionary insights at the altar of political correctness. This sort of argument is, as we also saw with EBD, ubiquitous among the pseudoscientists and also, obviously, very slimy.
Positively greasy, Dana. But at least a few of Coppens' stronger, pro-woo-woo arguments deserve a cursory response from a responsible skeptic. And the most important of these touches on a genuine, fascinating, real-world phenomenon. start, I'm going to try to give you what's called a steel man version of Coppin's argument. In case you're not familiar with the term, it's definition time.
His favorite time of all.
I'm giddy. Okay, you know what a straw man is, right? Like, your friend and you are discussing a neighborhood restaurant recently purchased by Seamus O'Malley, and you mention that since the change in ownership, the quality has really gone downhill. Your friend sneers, "So, you just think all Irish people can't cook?" Hopefully, the error here is obvious. Your friend restated your argument to say something you never intended, in order to make it sound weaker than in your original formulation.
Though anyone who visited Ireland between its prehistory and, say, the late 1990s might fairly argue that ethnically Irish cooking in the old country did leave a lot to be desired.
No lie. But even still, there's nothing in your original argument that suggests you were making such a sweeping statement. And it's also clear that this reformulation makes the argument much easier for your friend to dismiss. So then, creating a straw man is misstating your opponent's argument to make it easier for you to refute. A steel man is the opposite. You take the argument your opponent is making, presumably one that you completely disagree with, and you try to restate it in the strongest form possible, thus the steel in the term. The objective is to ensure that, before you go poking holes, you have accurately expressed the argument's strengths. And the best way to verify that your steel man holds up is by getting your opponent to agree to your characterization of his own words.
This is a very good thing to do in real life. It ensures that both people are accepting a baseline set of facts before tackling the dispute itself. The next time you're in an argument with your significant other and it seems to be going nowhere, try steel manning your loved one's point of view. If your explanation doesn't reflect what they actually believe instead of what you think they believe, then you have some listening to do before you get back to talking.
Okay, so let's steelman Coppin's position regarding an argument he makes about real agreed-upon history. Specifically, his suggestion that future historians might have trouble convincing their readers that mid-20th century humans landed on the moon.
Fast forward several hundred, if not thousand years, and what would we see? What would we remember? Would anything survive? Let's be totally realistic and ask what our ancestors 1,000 years from now will find at Cape Canaveral. Will any of the metal launch platforms survive? Unlikely. Some of the ruins of the buildings might be found, but maybe not even that. If we are lucky, there might be accounts of how, for a brief period of time, humankind sent people into space, and that we once went to the moon. Today, there are several popular authors who hotly contest that we ever went to the moon, arguing that the landing was just American propaganda created to instill a sense of superiority over the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War. Though I do not agree, let us assume that some of their writings also survive the test of time, and that future historians incorporate them in their accounts. Future history might then say that there was a widely held belief that humans walked on the moon, but even in their own times, some thought otherwise. The historians might go on to say that they have found archaeological evidence at Cape Canaveral, but that the question of whether or not we ever went into space or to the moon cannot be proven. I hear some thinking, hold on here, what about the hundreds of satellites orbiting our planet? Isn't there physical evidence of our presence on the moon? The photographs of Cape Canaveral and its numerous launches, the hours of footage shot on board the various space shuttle missions, assuming it all survives the next millennium, it will indeed all add to the controversy. But if a historian wants to explain it all away, he can do so. That is precisely what those unwilling to believe we went to the moon are doing at this very moment.
Well, this is ridiculous. Obviously, we went to the moon, and there's going to be physical evidence of that. Not only the ruins of the launch pads, archived news stories, etc., but also the literal landers and various modified American flags, literally on the fucking moon itself.
All true. And his suggestion that the moon landing would ever have as little evidence as the various ancient aliens hypotheses is absolutely risible.
I feel like there's a but coming on.
Yeah, a big one. The thing is, he's right in one specific, limited sense. It is absolutely true that as time passes, the evidence for literally every historical thing gets worse. That is to say, the evidence for the moon landing will definitely be weaker in, for example, my kids' lifetimes than it was in my parents' lifetimes. And that's because the actual eyewitnesses, the astronauts, the NASA staff, the tens of thousands of people who worked on the Apollo missions, the hundreds of millions who saw the live feed from the moon on their black and white TVs, are, like all of us, unfortunately mortal. And so their ability to provide personal, verifiable accounts, along with all of the rich detail that is part of their experience but never made it into the historical record, will die with them. As I hope all of you know, I am as certain as it's possible for a human being to be that the moon landings and all the associated missions indeed happened. But I'm actually too young to have seen them on TV.
Huh. I didn't realize you were too young for anything.
Quiet, or I'll smack you with this rolled-up AARP magazine, unicorn.
Calm down, and I'll get you a fruit cup.
The kind with cherries? Okay, I'll be good. The point is, you're never going to have better evidence for a historical event than you have the second after that event happens. As time goes on, even a huge, extremely well-reported event, the bombing of Hiroshima, for example, or the events of 9/11, become less well-attested simply through the deaths of witnesses, natural changes.
They rebuilt Hiroshima, for example, removing all of the radioactive rubble that served as proof for the bombing, and they similarly cleared away the wreckage of the Twin Towers, rebuilt the Pentagon, etc.
Plus, some of the websites that covered 9/11 in the years afterward have probably gone offline. And maybe some of the newspapers published in the aftermath of Hiroshima haven't been properly archived. Again, there's no question these things happened, and in fact, we've done shows on how ridiculous 9/11 truther conspiracies and moon landing deniers are. But it's also true that there is less evidence for each historical event the more remote that event becomes in time. It's like the inevitable fall into entropy that everything suffers. It just can't be avoided in the universe we all inhabit.
Things fall apart, as the poet said.
We can conclude, then, that the more ancient a piece of human history is, all things being equal, the worse our sources for information on that occurrence will be. And it's in the gaps in our historical understanding that unfounded allegations, like ancient aliens, take root. It's a pseudo-historical version of the God of the Gaps idea.
That term, referring to the idea that theology has retreated gradually in the face of scientific discoveries, into ever more limited spaces where God can or has acted in the world. At one time, Zeus was impregnating women and tossing thunderbolts. These days, sophisticated theologians suggest that, while obviously evolution happened, maybe God set it in motion and guided it. The Big Bang explains the expansion and composition of the universe, but maybe God kicked that off too.
The ancient aliens version depends on our fragmentary and woefully incomplete view of how ancient cultures lived, worshipped, and thought about their surroundings to provide spaces in which their completely unsubstantiated allegations can fester. Thing is, though, that while Coppens can, and arguably should, point out how much we don't know, that doesn't give him license to suggest that whatever twaddle he and fellow theorists can come up with is just as supported as historians' carefully researched theories. There's another point he makes that I think is worth discussing here, and which is certainly germane to the entire ancient aliens hypothesis. In fact, this phenomenon is perhaps the only real-world, genuine historical data point that argues even slightly in favor of that suggestion. That is the phenomenon of cargo cults.
Thank you.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kyler Tsinis.
Kayla Itsinis. I'm Kayla Itsinis, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.